Welcome to science class. Day three.
I'm sure you all saw John Lee up here. He was commenting on how embarrassing it would be if your whole lesson would just flop if your PowerPoint wasn't working. So we got it working now. So as he learns more about PowerPoint in the middle of the night, I'm sure he'll start to appreciate it. Let's review a little bit. We're going to take an open book test here. And review a little bit about what we talked about yesterday. Yesterday we talked about the foundation of evolution as a certain principle that all old Earth philosophies and things are based on. Anybody remember what that principle is called? Doug! Good, that's hard to say. The principle of uniformitarianism. Can anybody kind of put in your own words what it means? Yeah. A huge assumption. That those rates have always been the same. They've always continued on forever. And who prophesied? Well, let me rephrase the question, because when you go to college, you got to realize this. When you're taking a test, you're putting on a test what the opinions of your professor. That's what you're doing. So this is, I guess, maybe an opinion of me. Who prophesied in the Bible that people would say these things, that would say that things would just are going on as they've always gone on? Who did that? Who said that? It was Peter, and where was that? Okay, 2 Peter 3, verses 3 through 6 is the ones I use. And in that prophecy, what did Peter say that people would deliberately do? Forget, right? They deliberately forget. And he mentioned two things on why this principle of uniformitarianism is not valid, because they forget two things, major things that happened in our history. What were those two things? Creation and the flood. Good. Very good. You guys are good students. I also, as a teacher, have absolutely no problem if all of my students are smarter than Mike Manning. No problem whatsoever with that. Did I miss that point the other day? Actually, I really enjoyed Mike Manning's class. On the very first day, all of a sudden I realized that the treble clef was a G and the bass clef was an F, and it shows where the notes are on that, and I was mesmerized right from that point. So he was like, "Does everybody know that?" And I was like, "Yeah, I knew that." So I've been learning a lot from his class. Very good. I'm glad. Those are the main points. There's a lot of other things I talked about yesterday, and I'm sure you forgot a lot of it. And that's fine, because those are the main things that I want us to understand. That principle of uniformitarianism is very important to understand that idea and how that goes into evolution. Evolution has some problems. It has quite a few problems. One of the problems that I don't think we talk about very much, and to me it seems like it's the overwhelming problem, is the amount of time it has to actually devote to defending itself. You know, are there any other branches of science that the majority of the people, the practitioners in that branch of science, spend their time writing books, giving lectures on trying to convince people that it's actually true? And they spend an inordinate amount of time trying to defend itself. Why is that? It's because it's so easily debatable. It's not based on real science, so it's really easy to debate. It's not based on real observations and experimentation. And evolutionists, generally also known as atheists, are incensed that you won't just blindly follow their faith. And you're going to experience this. It's an interesting phenomenon. They are just irate if you won't just accept what they are saying. And that's because it's a faith-based science. It's based on evidence of things not seen. That's what they base their the evolution on. Ironically, evolution is a creation. It's a creation of the devil. God created the universe, and the devil created evolution as a counter to that. For to try to bring you away from accepting the correct truth, the absolute truth. It's an attempt to destroy God, and they will hate you for not joining them. They will hate you for not joining them. Other sciences improve by being questioned. That's what we do. We're improved by being questioned. What about this? Maybe it's like this, and then we We look at the evidence and we try to change the paradigm and we try to figure out these relative truths about the world that God has created. But don't you dare question evolution. You do not dare to question it. It's something that you need to just accept. And I've told this story several times, but when I was in college, I ended up having to take another science class, and it could be really a low-level science class, and so I took this geology class, and my wife was actually in the class with me. We won't talk about all those experiences, but the class was, for me, I'd taken a lot of science, and for me, it was a pretty easy class, and I won't say how easy, but I did meet a lot of Iowa football players in the class, and did a lot of keeping certain people eligible, because go Hawks. We took this class, and I think it was fairly hard for some of those people that were in it, but for me, it was pretty straightforward and pretty easy, and in the end, I ended up getting an A+, so thanks. Where's Kimber at? I need my I'm awesome hat. Yeah, all right. Just start taking pictures of me again. I was invited to the professor's house, and Ginger got to come along with me. And there was one other girl that also aced the class, and so they invite us to their house. But on the very last day of class, the class had been pretty interesting, going along pretty good, but on the very last day, one of the professors, there was two professors that taught this class, one of the professors got up and really didn't teach us anything new that entire day. He just went off on how evolution is fact, and if you don't believe it, you are an idiot. And I was just mesmerized by what he was doing. And he was just spouting and going, you know. And I can be kind of facetious at times, and I was in the back row, and I was just like, what's this, you know? And he was just going crazy, you know. And all these people that really, you know, didn't really know any better, you know, were there, and he knew that. That's what he knew. That's why he was doing it there. I'm not sure he would have done it in a different kind of a setting, but I was just in the back row, and I was just thinking, I'd just like to, you know, testify, Brother Darwin. You know, that's what it was. It was a sermon. It was a sermon, and you had to believe this, and he wasn't going to show you any evidence of it, but you needed to believe this. And there were people around. I just felt that there's a huge class, and they were all just like, okay. You know, like, you know, and they're just going to accept it. You know, a lot of people just accept these things, and that's it. So anyway, I got invited to his house, and we came in there, and both the professors and their wives were there, and my wife and this other girl from the class, and we sit down, and you know, and I had kind of shrugged it off. I didn't let it bother me too much about his lecture earlier that morning. But then we sat down, and it was all an entire vegetarian meal. So that got me going again. And I suppose we're not supposed to eat our animal brothers or something. But anyway, it was like there was nothing I felt like I really wanted to eat in there. And so we all sit down, and my mind started, and sometimes it shouldn't do this, and I shouldn't say things that I'm thinking about. But I turned to him, and I said, would you like me to offer the blessing on this food? Should we offer a blessing to the Lord?
The announcement just said all the parts on the south lot has to move.
No, right, the shop doors.
If you're parked in front of the shop doors, which I don't think I am, then you need to move, right? You got it? Okay. They're going to move all the cars. Okay. All right. So anyway, I turned to the professor, and I said, would you like me to offer the blessing on this fine food that we have here? And my wife thought it was hilarious and started laughing because she was in the class. And the other professor actually was really, he thought it was funny and stuff, but you should have seen this guy. You don't do this until after you got your grade. I'd already gotten my grade. So he was just bright red and was very, he was visibly upset, and I felt bad about it afterwards. You shouldn't do that. You shouldn't make people upset in that way. And it might not have been the best thing that I could have done, but it did help us get out. We left pretty quickly, because I had to go to McDonald's and something to eat. But you're going to have arguments with people, and you're going to have to discuss this topic. You're going to have to. I hope you can be ready for that. But I don't want you to be timid about that. You shouldn't be timid about talking about this. Because in the end, it's really actually pretty easy. They're arguing with you, and you can just say, well, I just don't believe what you believe. That's enough. Say that. I believe that God created the whole universe in 6 days. And it's kind of fun. Say that. They will be incredibly mad at you for that. But it's, that's all right. That's on them. And you can just say, well, I'm sorry you're angry, but I just don't believe that. And they'll say things like, but there's no scientific, what's your science behind that? What's your logic behind that? And you can say, I'm not a scientist. I don't have to have science behind it. I'm a Christian. And God told me what he did. And I believe it. And that's really all you need to say. You don't really need to spend time going through some of these things, these theories and things that we're looking at. It might almost be a waste of your time. It doesn't matter what you're going to come up with, no matter what good evidence would even show up. If some amazing evidence showed up in the fossil record right now, it would not matter. It would not matter. They will take it and they will try to put it into that paradigm of, because if they have to reject their paradigm, then they have to accept that God is true. And they will not do that. They will not do that. So it doesn't really matter what evidence you're going to try to give to them. They're gonna try to fit it into their paradigm. Today we'd like to talk about evolution versus the watchmaker. In recent years, there's been a resurgence of what people call intelligent design. Have we all heard about this? Intelligent design. And basically, intelligence, it's really come forward lately in the movie Expelled. Everybody's seen that movie Expelled with Ben Stein? Okay? Some people have seen it. Me and my son went and watched it. I just because I like Ben Stein, I think he's really... Welcome to science class. That's actually who I'm impersonating, but no one probably knew that. So we went and watched this movie, and it really talks about this, the concept of intelligent design that's being renewed. And the idea is basically that there's things that are so complex that if you see them, you would just automatically assume that they had to be, there's a function and a purpose for certain things, and there had to be then a designer, an intelligent designer. And this is always in what we call the watchmaker analogy, where if you came across a watch in a field and you picked it up and someone said, how did this come into being? It's fairly logical to say that there's a watchmaker or something that somebody or something and some intelligent designer made it. And so this intelligent design comes out of this watchmaker analogy. And this watchmaker analogy is not something that's just real recent. The watchmaker analogy, at least as far back as I can trace it, goes at least 2,000 plus years back into history. And I would imagine it probably goes even back even further than that. But I tried to kind of trace down through time some of the peoples that kind of used this kind of analogy. And the first one I could find, and like I said, I think it probably goes even back beyond him, was, do you see all those flashes and colors of light, John? That's pretty cool. Good job. Was Cicero. And Cicero said, when you see a sundial or a water clock, you see that it tells the time by design and not by chance. How then can you imagine that the universe as a whole is devoid of purpose and intelligence when it embraces everything, including these artifacts themselves and their artificers or the makers of these artifacts? You see what he's saying there? You see a sundial, and what do you assume? You don't assume it just came into being by chance. You assume that there was a creator or a designer. René Descartes, nor will this appear at all strange to those who are acquainted with the variety of movements performed by the different automata or moving machines fabricated by human industry, and that with help of but few pieces compared with the great multitude of bones, muscles, nerves, arteries, veins, and other parts that are found in the body of each animal. Such persons will look upon this body as a machine made by the hands of God, which is incomparably better arranged and adequate to movements more admirable than is any machine of human invention. See that? There's all these machines, but when we look at the human body or the body of different animals, we see that it is so much more remarkably made than any machine that we've ever made. And so we have this idea that there has to be some intelligent designer. Robert Boyle, The universe is like a rare clock, where all things are so skillfully contrived that the engine being once set a-moving, all things proceed according to the Creator's first design. Robert Hooke, for as diverse watches may be made out of several materials which may yet have all the same appearance and move after the same manner, that is, show the hour equally true, the one as the other, and out of the same kind of matter, like watches, may be wrought differing ways, so may it be with these most curious engines of insect bodies. The all-wise God of nature may have so ordered these little automatons to be one way, and out of the same materials ordered others to be a different way. Robert Hooke. Voltaire. One way of acquiring the notion of being a being who directs the universe is by considering the end to which each thing appears to be directed. When I see a watch with a hand would mark the hours. So when I see the springs of the human body, I conclude that an intelligent being as designed begins to be received and nourished within the womb for 9 months, for eyes to be given for seeing, hands for grasping, and so on. From this I see that there is something more powerful than myself. Thomas Paine. All the knowledge man has of science and machinery comes from the great machine and structure of the universe, the constant and unwearied observations of our ancestors upon the movements and revolutions of the heavenly bodies have brought this knowledge upon earth. It is not Moses and the prophets, nor Jesus Christ, nor his apostles that have done it. The Almighty is the great mechanic of the creation, the first philosopher and original teacher of all science. Let us then learn to reverence our master, and let us not forget the labors of our ancestors. I have a little bit of problem with each one of these, actually, but I had kind of a bigger problem with this one. What's the problem with what he said there? Jesus Christ, John 1, right? Jesus Christ was there at the beginning. We'll create man in whose likeness? Our likeness, right? Our likeness. And then we come to who is really the main person that's credited with the watchmaker analogy. Everybody quotes him when they're quoting the watchmaker analogy rather than all those people that actually came before him that also used the same analogy, probably because he just put it a little bit better and he put it in a big book. And his book was called, this is William Paley, and his book was called Natural Theology, or Evidences of the Existence and Attributes of the Deity Collected from the Appearances of Nature. Remember I told you their titles are really, really long, and the books that they had back then. It was published in 1802, which is like 50-some years right before Darwin. And so this was the main thought of the day. Everybody agreed with William Paley on this until people tried to come up with something to try to reject him. And this is what William Paley wrote in his book. In crossing a heath, suppose I pitched my foot against a stone and were asked how the stone came to be there. I might possibly answer that for anything I knew to the contrary, it had lain there forever. Nor would it perhaps be very easy to show the absurdity of this answer. But suppose I had found a watch upon the ground, and it should be inquired how the watch happened to be in that place. I should hardly think of the answer I had before given, that for anything I knew, the watch might have always been there. There must have existed at some time and at some place or other an artificer or artificers who formed the watch for the purpose which we find it actually to answer, who comprehended its construction and designed its use. Every indication of contrivance, every manifestation of design, nature of being greater or more, and that in a degree which exceeds all computation. The difference being that in nature we see things that are so much more complex than a simple watch that we have to obviously assume that there is a creator, an intelligent designer. I found a poem. So this is today's version of it. I found a poem, and I would like to read this. I'm not really big on reading a lot of poems, but I thought this was pretty good. So and there's a little video that I found that kind of goes along with it. So I'd like to, if you'll indulge me, I'd like to read this this poem to you as you kind of watch the play-by-play. A long time ago, on a planet so bare, some water and dirt got mixed up with the air. Some sand and some rocks to make it just right. The stage was all set in the deep of the night. A bolt of white lightning, a great peal of thunder, and suddenly there was a marvelous wonder. The rocks yielded metal, The sand turned to glass, and a new thing came to pass. The metal formed, and little by little, things fell right into place. The parts came together, just like a good rhyme, with ticks and with talks and with hands that tell time. A beautiful watch began ticking one day, formed all by itself in a wonderful way. Ridiculous story, you say with a grin. Impossible, laughable, surely a sin. A watch needs a watchmaker, that's plain to see. A designer and a builder, that makes it for me. Now all life is made of some interesting stuff. Cells of all shapes like blobs filled with fluff. But looks are deceiving, and what we find there are factories and highways and gadgets to spare. Assembly lines, robots, electrical cable, libraries, software, just look if you're able. The marvels we see with a microscope stare make a watch look so simple we dare not compare. Now the doctors from Oxford say cells came by chance, from goo down to you in a beautiful dance. What's wrong with our thinking to have such odd notions that cells could just happen from dirt and warm oceans? A cell and its wonders amaze all who see. And a cell, like a watch, by chance cannot be. Alan Free, bumblebee, snails, a gigantic oak tree. A woodpecker built with a jackhammer nose, lightning bugs, monkeys, a beautiful rose. And beetles with bombs that give frogs a surprise, chameleons with camouflage and some very weird eyes. All nature on earth is so wondrously fine, we have to admit that it's all by design. And our maker owns everything, both great and small. He's the masterful watchmaker, Lord over all. That's the watchmaker analogy. That's the newest version, which I kind of enjoy. That's a really good thought, that there is a, from the complex creation, we know that there has to be a creator. But the best quote that I found is this one. Clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. There's the watchmaker analogy, put to best. That's inspired right there. Does anybody recognize this person here? Anybody know this person? It's kind of dark. I can't see it very good. Anybody know him? Richard Dawkins, right. He was in the movie Expelled. He was the one that Ben Stein interviewed. Richard Dawkins is... Apparently my son has prejudged him. Richard Dawkins is the premier evolutionist of today. It was Stephen Gould, who was an American evolutionist. Richard Dawkins is from Britain. And he is the... If you start watching now, you'll see him. He's everywhere he can be, spouting his lies. And he has written a lot of books, and he's supposed to be a evolutionary biologist, but all his books are about you and how you're dumb. That's what it is. It's all explanations of things. And just look at the titles of some of his books. These are just a couple of his books. 1986, he wrote The Blind Watchmaker, a response to William Paley's watchmaker theory. In 2006, and I'm sure some of you have heard of this, and this is recent, it was pretty big, he wrote The God Delusion. He writes books against God and against creation, although he's supposed to be a biologist, and talking about biology, he doesn't do that very often. And this is one of the quotes from... We have to have a talk later. This is one of the quotes from his this is from the blind watchmaker. If complex things must have been intelligently designed by something more complex than themselves, then anything proposed to be this complex designer must also have been designed by something yet more complex. That's going to be his argument against the watchmaker. Well, if it's so complex, that means it has to have a designer. Then that designer is going to be complex, and then it has to have a designer. And because of that, that's one of the, I don't want to take people's winds out of their sails. Because I know, I've actually heard this week a lot of people talking about, yeah, well, you know, intelligent design. And I am not a big proponent of intelligent design. I'll just tell you, and I know that's going to be. I don't want to ruin people's view of this, but I've talked to some of you about this before. I don't believe an intelligent designer created the universe. I believe God created the universe. And whenever we put names on God that God has not allowed us to use, like Yahweh or Jehovah or I Am, whenever we use names that aren't that He doesn't attribute to Himself, we lower Him. I don't want to just say that He's an intelligent designer. I mean, this PowerPoint's a pretty good creation, I think. So it has to have been created by someone. Well, yeah, Nikki's a pretty good intelligent designer on this. So he's an intelligent designer. So why would we say that God is an intelligent designer? We're not going to compare the two. So I don't really like using that. Sometimes it gets really bad when I hear people say the big man upstairs. That just about drives me crazy. We need to show the proper respect for our Creator. And so I don't like using the word intelligent design. And my students at school, they ask me about intelligent design. And I tell them straight up, I don't like that term. And first thing they think of is, ooh, I'm against God. And I say, God created the universe, not an intelligent designer. I'm not going to call him intelligent. I mean, what's intelligent? I don't have a word I can use to describe my Creator. So let's be wary about that, because when we use in terms like that, it lessens him, and then we have someone like this that can say these things. Well, he's just an intelligent designer is all he is. And a lot of times, even Cicero, remember what Cicero said? You know, artificers. He was from the Roman Empire, right? Did they believe in one God? No, he said there's a lot of creators. And some of these intelligent designers don't even really believe in a God. Blue SUV parked in front of the semi. And Greg will go move that. So there are some intelligent designers out there that don't even really believe in a God. A lot of them are agnostic. They just think that there's some kind of, you know, there's something there, but they don't necessarily believe in God or let alone Jesus Christ, which is what we need to be believing in. And so just because you say you're an intelligent designer doesn't mean that you're necessarily talking about God. In fact, in the movie Expelled, I don't know if you remember this, but when Ben Stein was interviewing him, you know, he said, well, how did life, you know, life just showed up. How did that happen? And he even said, he goes, well, you know, I mean, there's also other possibilities. There's, you know, it could have been planted here by, like, aliens or something. And that's a whole theory now. It's an evolutionary theory called panspermia. That there's some kind of life sperm that is planted here that then can evolve, and that process can just keep on going. And you keep on saying, well, yeah, but where did that come from? And then they're like, well, you know, it came from another planet. And they'll just keep saying another planet until you die and stop asking that question to them. This is the way it works. So even Richard Dawkins is saying, in that sentence, he was saying that, yeah, it could have been intelligent design. Some other alien could have planted this there. So when you're talking about, I just want you to be real careful about calling yourself an intelligent, you're a believer in intelligent design. Just believe in God and state it that way. There's nothing wrong with that. I should have checked some of these. here's another quote by Richard Dawkins. I contend that a supernatural creator almost certainly does not exist, and that belief in a personal God qualifies as a delusion. This is from his book, The God Delusion, which is defined, a delusion is defined, as a persistent false belief held in the face of strong contradictory evidence. When one person suffers from a delusion, it is called insanity. When many people suffer from a delusion, it is called religion. You know, I was going to play, I was going to have Nikki do some kind of word changing here, but I'll reread this, and I'll just change like two words. Okay? I contend that a supernatural creator almost certainly does exist, and that belief in Darwin qualifies as a delusion, which is defined as a persistent false belief held in the face of strong contradictory evidence. When one person suffers from a delusion, it is called insanity. When many people suffer from it, it is called the theory of evolution. That's what I believe. You can easily change that around and see exactly what he's saying the other way. Ironically, according to Amazon.com, when this book, God Delusion, came out, it led to a 120% increase in the sales of Bibles. Isn't it always funny how that works? Isn't that? Yeah, you can think of a lot of examples of how that kind of thing works. 120% increase in the sales of Bibles. Ha! Here's something he said from the blind watchmaker. And this is, listen to this. This is what he said from the blind watchmaker. We do not actually disagree with Paley's laying out of the problem. We don't actually disagree with Paley's laying out of the problem. There is a problem. We just only disagree with the solution. What does that mean? That means that they agree that there's a problem. Things are way more complex, and every year we realize they're way more complex than we ever dreamed they could have possibly been. And that makes evolution seem like we need to even throw some more time in there. I mean, the probabilities get lower and lower. If you can go, you know, closer to zero. It gets worse and worse. There's a problem. And Dawkins says, we don't really disagree with it, that Paley's laying out a problem of complexity. We just disagree, or we reject his solution to the problem. That's what he's saying. He said, well, yeah, there's an obvious problem there that it makes it look like that there is, it's complex, it makes it look like, yes, there could be something there that's creating it, but we don't believe that there is, and therefore we're going to come up with a different solution. That's all. We're just going to provide some kind of a different solution to this. Romans 1:21 through 23. Because that when they knew God, they glorified Him not as God, neither were thankful. They knew God, but they rejected. They were glorified Him not, neither were they thankful, but they became vain in their own imaginations, coming up with their own stuff. And their foolish heart was darkened, professing themselves to be wise. I really like that one. Professing themselves to be wise. You go to college and you will meet your professors of wisdom. That's what they will say they are. I am your professor of wisdom, and you put on the test what I believe, my vain imaginations. I had an entire class that was based on the 2001 Space Odyssey. We watched the movie, and he lectured on that movie forever. And every question was what his views were on the meaning of that movie. I needed the credit hours. Don't ask me why I was in there. But it was their professors. Professing themselves to be wise, they became fools. And they changed the glory of the uncorruptible God into irreducible complexity. Okay? And I'll just read this out slowly and see if you can try to grasp what this is saying. The base level, this is the definition of irreducible complexity. The base level of complexity below which a system no longer functions. Thus, an irreducibly complex system is one comprising of several unique interacting components that contribute to the basic function of the system, and wherein the removal of just one of those components renders the whole system no longer functional. Is this making sense? An irreducibly complex system cannot evolve by slight single-step successive modifications to a precursor system, because any precursor to an irreducibly complex system that is missing a part is by definition non-functional, and as such would have no purpose and presumably could not be the subject of natural selection. Natural selection will select something that has some kind of a positive function to it, and then there's variations of that, and then it will select something that helps it out even more, right? This is the idea of evolution, until we have something that is an incredibly complex thing that's supposed to be functional. And this doesn't happen. I mean, this is how can you imagine this happening? And what we would use as an example is, we'll use something really simple, actually, not all that complex. We'll use a mouse trap. So I could divide this up into a whole bunch of different parts. I could give you a wooden platform. Now, what's evolution going to say? Evolution will say that after a while, once that wooden platform has caught some mice, and eventually it kind of evolves and changes in its offspring, and there's kind of an appendage on there that can evolve into kind of a spring, which of course will help it catch some more mice. Then there's some more modifications, and eventually it can have a little bar on there which will help it catch some more mice, apparently. Until we finally get this very complex, amazing mouse-catching device. That's not going to make sense. Right? I mean, we're not going to catch mice with the wooden platform. And so we have all these different parts that can go together, and we talk about them all evolving at the same, all for a certain purpose that it doesn't know. Natural selection even says that there has to be a purpose for that thing to be selected. And if there's not a purpose there in that part of it, it doesn't know the end purpose of catching the mice. Am I making sense here on this? It doesn't understand the end purpose of catching the mice. So how can those things be selected for to be all, on the grand scheme, to be put all together to make that mousetrap? And what we now know today is that the irreducible complexity associated with even just a single cell of an organism puts the mousetrap to shame. The cascading of hundreds of biochemical reactions that all need to work together to have some overall function, one of which not working can destroy the cell. How did that all evolve together? And so this is the concept of irreducible complexity. And this is what Charles Darwin said in his book on the Origin of Species. He said, if it could be demonstrated, and a lot of creationists use this quote, and they're not going to use it quite the way I'm going to use it, but a lot of people use this. If it could not, this is what he wrote in the book, in his book that he wrote. If it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory, would absolutely break down. Now, a lot of creationists will use this quote. Okay.
Sorry.
No problem. Moving vans, cleaning up leaks. This is the job of an elder right here. Desire of the office. On this quote. Okay. So, a lot of times people will use this quote and they'll say, see, if Charles Darwin was alive today, he would... From his own words, would reject his theory. Because he had absolutely, this is way before we see how the eye functions and the cell, the functions of the cell, that if he saw those today, he'd say, well, I was wrong. It's way too complex. Because that's what he said here. I completely do not agree with that. And creationists like to do that, like to say that. I completely reject that. If Darwin were here today, he would go talk to Richard Dawkins, and Dawkins would explain to him all the lies that he's said since Darwin's been dead on how we can continue to hold on to it. That's what would happen. Darwin would cling to his theory, and he would try to incorporate all the lies that have been said about how that this could actually still be possible. So I don't believe that this was written in the book on the Origin of Species, which is a book of complete lies. So I don't know why we would think that this could be true. Once the devil is the author of the lies, and once the lies start, that's all that is ever uttered out of the mouth. I mentioned yesterday, and I want to kind of reiterate the point, that evolution didn't really arise from science. It kind of arose from a time period. The 16th through the 18th century, we had the Age of Reason, we had a revolutions, we had the Age of Enlightenment, right up to what we consider the Age of Modernism today. And all of these ages are really, to me, just one big idea of worshiping ourselves. And they just really said, we're going to now worship reason. We're going to reject God. They put Bibles literally into coffins, carried them down the streets, and buried them. I think we actually read about some of this. And they tried to change things. They tried to change times, dates and times. We've heard that, right? People will try to change dates and times. Try to change times that God has created. Instead of having the week, which is directly from the creation, we're going to reject creation. We're going to change the week. We're going to have a 10-day week. We're going to call it a decade. This is where we get this word. Now it's 10 years, but at that time it was 10 days. We're going to have a 10-day period where do what you want. Revelry, decadence. This is where we get decade from. This is what we're going to do. We're going to reject even the times. We're not going to have a week. We're going to have a 10-day period, which of course didn't last very long. Napoleon even stated, people without God will eventually die. And people turn back. People always kind of turn back. You don't want to be in that sad state. And people eventually will, hopefully, usually will come back. But even in today's period, we're still doing this. We're changing times. You know, we used to have what we called B.C., which stood for what? Before Christ. And be careful on this one. Every time I ask this question, sometimes I get an answer I don't really want to hear. And A.D., which stands for? Good. All right. Anno Domini, which means in the year of our Lord. I did some of this in front of some of my students at outside of school, and I asked that, and they all said, after death. And I was like, okay, now we got 33 years that we're not counting at all. So it's in the year of our Lord. Well, do we still have those? No, you can even look in textbooks, and they're being changed. They're all being changed. And I had my other biology teacher in my school. We were at this event. We were watching this history thing, and they put up these years, and they had BCE, and then they had CE. And he was like, "What's that?" And he is a biology teacher. Things because we want to make sure we're rejecting Christ. And so BCE stands for what? You guys know about this? Or have you guys seen these? What is it? Before the common era, right? Before the common era, and then CE is the common era. So we changed these because we want to get Christ out of this, and we don't want to offend our Muslim brothers and everybody else that we're supposed to be tolerating and all inclusive of people that apparently salvation is only found in Jesus Christ is a moot point. Darwinism and Darwin staunchly followed this lead. The theory must be right, because in their eyes there was no alternative. Much of Darwin's and his colleagues' writings are just like Dawkins' books. They are more about refuting God rather than discussing science. And there's a couple quotes here that I want to look at. This is Thomas Huxley, and if you remember from a couple days ago, I think it was, or maybe yesterday, I don't know, I'm losing track of time. Thomas Huxley coined what word? Agnosticism, right? He's the one that coined this word. And this is in a letter that he wrote to Darwin right before Darwin was going to publish this. Huxley was really trying to convince him to get it out there and to publish this. And he wrote, "I finished your book yesterday. Nothing I have ever read has made so great an impression on me, and I do most heartily thank you for the great store of new views you have given me. As for your doctrines, I am prepared to go to the stake." What does that mean? Go to the stake. No, this is a problem. This came out, in my opinion, came out of the apostate church. It's one evil replacing another evil. And he says, "I am prepared to go to the stake if required. I trust you will not allow yourself to be in any way discouraged by the considerable abuse and misrepresentation which, unless I greatly mistake, is in store for you. And as to the mangy dogs which will bark and yelp at you, please remember that I am endowed with a great amount of combativeness which you may find helpful. I am sharpening my claws and beak in readiness." Thomas Huxley. He was known in the cartoons. They had cartoons back there. You've seen the Darwin's head on the ape, right? And they had cartoons back then too. And he was known as Darwin's bulldog. By the way, Dawkins now is known as Darwin's Rottweiler. I don't know if you, that's his famed pseudonym, I guess. Romans 1, they became vain in their imaginations, didn't they? They became vain in their imaginations. Another quote by Darwin later in life. Although I did not think much about the existence of God until a considerably later period of my life, I will here give the vague conclusions to which I have been driven. The old argument of intelligent design in nature as given by William Paley, which formerly seemed to me so conclusive, fails now that I have discovered the law of natural selection. Vain in their imaginations. There are a set of fundamental laws that man has discovered in nature called the laws of thermodynamics, which we need to go over real quick. There's actually four laws. We're going to kind of just look at two of the laws of thermodynamics, and you'll find these in every textbook, that in every branch of science. And the first one is mass energy shall not be created nor destroyed. And you might have, from your own schooling, might think that's not quite the way it used to remember it being. There's mass will not be created nor destroyed, and then later on you can see energy cannot be created nor destroyed. But Einstein, in his weird equation, what's Einstein's equation? E equals MC squared. We might not have any idea what that means, but we all know E equals MC squared. E stands for?
Energy.
M stands for?
Mass.
And what does C stand for?
Speed of light.
Good. I thought about that one, so you should know that one. And it's C squared. Remember, the C, speed of light, was a really, 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 really big number, right? So what happens when you square a really big number? You get a ginormous number, right? So we have E equals M times a really big number. And what Einstein said there is that mass and energy are kind of really just two varieties of the same thing. And you could take mass, and you could, a little bit of mass, a tiny little bit of mass, and convert it into a huge amount of energy. You take a little bit of mass times a really big number, you're going to get a really big number. And of course, we ended a war based on that principle. So this is real. And but it's not going to say that we can just create mass or matter or energy out of nothing. Ex nihilo. We can't do that. We can't just create it out of nothing. But we can convert mass and energy kind of back and forth in between them. So this, though, is still kind of a violation. Right? Genesis 1:1, we don't have to get very far in the Bible before we find a violation. In the beginning, God created. And we have 2 Peter 3, 10 through 12, but the day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in the which the heavens shall pass away with a great noise, and the elements shall melt with fervent heat. The earth also and the works that are therein shall be burned up. Seeing then that all things shall be dissolved, what manner of persons ought you to be in all holy conversation of godliness, looking for and hastening to the coming of the day of God, wherein the heavens being on fire shall be dissolved, and the elements shall melt with fervent heat. It's going to be destroyed too. It was created, and it's going to be destroyed. And whenever I talk about this in class, because every year I do, I talk about this in my classes, I always write it on the board, or I put it in my notes on the on my website, with a little amendum to it. I always put that on there, and it's not lost on them. Mass energy should not be created nor destroyed by man. Because that's really what the law should be saying. That's what they're saying. They're saying they can't do it. They found out they can't do it. So that's they, that's them, that's man. Man cannot do this. So I have no problem really with this, as long as we put the by man on the end of it. Let's look at the second law of entropy. And what it means is that all order shall proceed to a state of disorder. Entropy is kind of a measure of order, or however you want to say it. If you have very low entropy, that means things are very well ordered and structured. If you have high entropy, that means that things are willy-nilly. And the second law of thermodynamics says that everything progresses towards chaos, really. Everything progresses towards high entropy, much disorder. A car will eventually rust, but rust will not car. We break things down. Things always will break down. They're not going to spontaneously form to make something unless there's energy that's put into it by something or from somewhere. And they'll have arguments against this, saying, "Well, it's, you know, we don't have a closed system. There's energy coming in from outside somewhere or something to try to get around this particular violation of law. Because evolution violates this law, right? Does that make sense? Evolution violates this law. How do we have something that's just complete random and then all of a sudden comes in together to make some amazingly complex organisms? That completely is violated. It's going the other way. Really far the other way. We're not going towards complete disorder in that case. So evolution is a completely violates this second law of thermodynamics, which we have in physics. If I open a perfume bottle and we let some particles escape, they're going to do what? They're going to fill up the whole room. They're going to randomly go all over the place, and they'll just go in, and we can fill. And eventually, we're going to have kind of an even distribution through both of these rooms. You would be absolutely shocked. It would be a miracle, wouldn't it be, if all of these things all of a sudden all came together and formed a watch or something? It's complete. It's a violation for that. This is not going to happen in this situation. It'll never. I don't care how much time people say. Well, if I give enough time, it could possibly happen. All these particles could come together. That's ridiculous. That's not going to happen. So we talk about irreducible complexity, and what I want us to realize here is I'm not even going to talk about how the amoeba came to be, or even how we would have evolved. I want to look at some other things that would have had to evolve, like reproduction. Just think about this. How did two things, you and your wife, evolve separately so that you were completely compatible and therefore could then have offspring? How does that happen? How does something like that evolve, the process of reproduction? How does that happen? What about flight? How does flight happen? Well, they say there was mammals, a lot of really clumsy mammals that were in trees, and they kept falling out. And eventually, people that had different appendages that maybe had a little bit more skin could actually glide down a little bit better. And then, as they, over billions of years, would continue to fall out of trees, then eventually, so if you want to learn to fly, just go fall out of a tree a whole bunch of times, and eventually you'll be able to take off into the heavens. It'll be great. And this is how flight possibly evolved. But there's a problem with that, because evolution, flight evolved in a whole bunch of different things. Insects fly. Mammals fly. And the bats fly. Right? And of course, birds. So this problem of flight had to evolve in a whole bunch of different ways. It's a problem. What about altruism? Now, evolutionists a lot of them still deny that altruism actually even is real. But altruism is the belief in or a practice of disinterested and selfless concern for the well-being of others. But we have these things like, you know, ants and bees that they are protecting the hive, protecting the queen, and will give up their life to save the hive or the prairie dogs, you know, the sentries or the meerkats. You know, there's some of my favorites. And they will give up their life, or they will sacrifice themselves for other things. And a lot of times evolution will say, well, that's because they're sacrificing for their own gene pool, to keep their own genes going. So how did this happen? How did the altruism evolve? In Dawkins, in his other book in 1976, The Selfish Gene, that was his other book, he said, natural selection will never produce in a being anything injurious to itself. For natural selection acts solely by and for the good of itself. There's what you get from evolution. Everybody for themselves. Everybody for themselves. No one will ever do anything, lay their life down for somebody else. This is what evolution is trying to tell you. This will never happen, although we see evidences of this. This is just selfish. It's pride. It's the devil. What was the devil's problem? What is the devil's problem? What was his condemnation? Lifted up with pride. That's always been what it is. And that's what's continued in here in evolution. Evolution is the product of the devil. Evolution of love. How does love evolve? How does this happen? You see what Richard Dawkins said there? What does John 15:13-14 say? Greater love hath no man than this, that a man lay down his life for his friends. And you are my friends, if you do whatsoever I command you. Evolution doesn't show me that. The absolute truth shows me that. Evolution of information. In theory and physics, that we think that information just can't arrive. And I know you think some of this is like science fiction, but we actually think about some of these things. Physicists have always said that you cannot travel back in time. You can technically travel kind of forward in time if you go really fast, the speed of light, and you come back and you're only aged 3 years when everybody else is aged 100 years. So you can see technology kind of in the future, but that's still your present. You can't go back or do anything. You can't go back. If I could go back, I could take all of Einstein's stuff, go back into his Swiss patent clerk's office, and go in and say, hey, look at this. And then he could write that, and then we'd have Einstein. Now, where'd that information come from? And it didn't come from me, or it didn't come from him. It just spontaneously arrived, and that's what physicists say is information theory, this theory, on why we cannot travel back in time. That's the reasoning. That's our reasoning, why we can't do it. Sounds pretty logical to me. We can't just have information kind of spontaneously come about. We're going to do biology today, but we're going to probably go through this pretty fast. This is kind of a computer animation. And computer animations, although they're pretty fancy, they still don't do anywhere we're close to the justice of what's really happening. We're inside a cell. Oh, it's going to be pretty dark, isn't it? Yeah, you're not going to be able to see this. Well, inside the cell, we have a genetic code. We have DNA. It's a double helix, and there's information in there. It's coded information, and we can go through all the base pairs, ATs, Cs, and Gs. Remember all those? And they all pair together, and there's a code written in there, and we can read this code, and we can produce new proteins. So we have this biological machine. These are just molecules that will unzip this DNA, and it'll come down through, and it'll read it. There's a logical sequencing that you pass down to your offspring, just a variation a little bit, but there's a code there, and it's there. Somehow it got there. And we can go and we can read and this is called translation here, where we can translate what the code is into messenger RNA, right? We have DNA, we get messenger RNA, and so we have a copy of the code. It translates. That's in the cell, and the messenger RNA, the code, the translated code, can go out the cell through these the nuclear pores, and then it'll go out here to some ribosomes, and it'll be attached on here. Here it comes. It'll get attached on there, and then there'll be some new nuclear machines that will come down, and we'll read it. And there's these other molecules, the RNA, anybody know what they are? They're little, shaped like a T. tRNA. And these tRNAs, they have little T's, they have an amino acid on one end of it, a molecule amino acid, and on the other end they have this codon, or these three bases that match up to these codons in this genetic have your own unique little code there. And then so the amino acids get attached together, and amino acids all together make a what? A protein. And so everything that you are in you, their physical means, is made this way, all these proteins for different functions in your body to do different things. And these proteins then have different functions on themselves, so they get folded up in a certain format. It has to be folded up in a functionary type of a format. It's all from that code. There it goes in, it's going to get folded up, and then something's going to come, it's going to take that protein to the part of the body that needs it. Irreducible complexity. How does this evolve? How does this information show up? How does it show up? We're going to have to move on. The problem is what they started saying later is that once they understood genetics a little bit, they said, well, we got to have more mutations. We have to have more mutations happening. And there's a problem there because all mutations, you'd have to have beneficial mutations. Well, mutations aren't beneficial. Mutations are deleterious. They take away from us. They make us worse. We're getting worse and worse. We are decaying. This is what's happening to us. And, I always want to say to Dawkins, I said, if you think mutations are going to be good, why do you avoid radiation? Go get irradiated. See what happens. You might turn into the X-Men. That's what we have an evolutionary cartoon, the X-Men, right? They've mutated into something better. Well, this isn't going to happen. Here's the main aid. We start having mutations. Eventually, we have something meaningless. So how can it get directed to something better? If we have in the code right now, it's meaningless. What does this mean now? I don't understand what this means. There's no information there. How can this all of a sudden come into new information, spontaneously come into something new? This is what evolutionists tell us is happening. They say it'll evolve. It'll evolve into when mutations will happen. It'll evolve into something new, a new function, some new amazing statement, some new thing. Cosmology is all there ever was, is, and will be, Carl Sagan. Here we go. It evolved. What happened in the transition period? That's a real problem. Okay. I think we might have to just go through some slides. Hopefully they'll go quickly. Romans 8, 1, 18 through 25. This is our second law of entropy from the Bible. I consider that our present sufferings are not worth comparing with the glory that will be revealed in us. The creation waits in eager expectation for the sons of God to be revealed, for the creation was subjected to frustration, not by its own choice, but by the will of the one who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be liberated from its bondage to decay and brought into the glorious freedom of the children of God. We know that the whole creation has been groaning as in the pains of childbirth right up to the present time. Not only so, but we ourselves who have first fruits of the Spirit groan inwardly as we wait eagerly for our adoption of sons, the redemption of our bodies. For this hope we were saved, but hope that is seen is no hope at all. Who hopes for what he already has? But if we hope for what we do not yet have, we wait for it patiently. We are groaning. Creation is worse, and it's our fault. It's our fault. It was perfect at the beginning, but it's our fault. We have a lot of other things we were going to look at, but I want to get to the demonstration, because that's when everybody wakes up. It's kind of funny. I say, okay, now time for the science demo. And I'm like, hey. Yeah, see that? They're alike, but they're different. And we have similar sequences in our amino acids. Is that shocking? Weren't we all made from the dust of the ground, even the animals? Weren't we made with all the same kind of building blocks? God put us all together. We'd be shocked that we have some similarities in our physical nature, right? We shouldn't be shocked by that. And they take those and they take differences between those and they do this crazy math on percent differences and they make these phylogenetic trees on how far removed different organisms are away from each other. And we will talk about that more later, so I can go ahead and skip that quickly. This, by the way, is something I don't know if you've seen this or not. This is Ernst's take on this. I put this up because it really bothers me, because I can remember 20 years ago today being in my evolution class and drawing these pictures into my notebook talking about how ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny, these big crazy words, which means that if you look at all the embryo stages, you will see our evolution. It'll look like a turtle and it'll look like this in our embryo, and it was a lie, a blatant lie, and they admitted it. Now it's all been proven, and they're taking these out, slowly but surely, out of the books, out of the museums. This was a lie. He was at the same time as Darwin, wanted to play the game. He just wasn't as good at it. What?
Wasn't as good at it, and yet it's still working on
it. It's still there, and they're trying to tweak it, is what they try to do. Genesis 1, I really kind of wanted to go through this, but I want you to just notice this, and you can read this yourself as you go through here. I'm sure you've read it before. But as you go down through, and you'll see I underlined a whole bunch of things. After their kind, after his kind, after his kind, after his kind, after his kind. This is all the way through the animals. And then we get to verse 26, and we have a complete different change of language. And God said, let us make man after his kind? No. Let us make man differently. In our image, after our likeness. Let them have dominion over the kinds. Man's not a kind. Okay? We're not in the animal kingdom. That's what evolution wants to tell you. You're in the animal kingdom. That's where you are. You're equal with the animals. So we have a difference here, and it's very evident in Genesis chapter 1. Let's go to the end and do the... I guess we use this verse real quick. Jude verse 10. Yet these men speak abusively against whatever they do not understand, what things they do understand by instinct. Like unreasoning animals, these are the very things that destroy them. This is exactly what they're doing. They're animals. We're in the animal kingdom, and if you're in the animal kingdom, you can be like the animals. You can do whatever you want, whatever feels good. You got no moral authority for you to bow down to. And if you believe in evolution, that's what you get. You can have that. What a great thing that can be, right? We are not like the animals. And 1 Corinthians 15 is a scripture you should read. Let's do the demonstration. Okay, so, everybody ready? Doing the demonstration, wake up. So, here we have some hydrogen peroxide, right? And hydrogen peroxide is actually a byproduct of some cells, but it kills cells too, right? You put it on things to kill the bacteria, so if a cell makes hydrogen peroxide, that's a problem, because it will kill the cell when it does it. But there's enzymes that have evolved that will break down the hydrogen peroxide so it won't kill it. Now, which one of those came first in the evolutionary process? How come life didn't die out when it started making hydrogen peroxide? If it hadn't evolved yet, the enzyme would break it down to keep it alive. That's a problem. So we're going to take some hydrogen peroxide, and we're going to put it in this bottle here. The hydrogen peroxide you have at home is 3%. This is 30%. So as soon as I do this, I might run away. That's just for safety precaution. And this is a reaction. We have H2O2, hydrogen peroxide. I'm going to go over just a little bit. I hope it's okay. Hydrogen peroxide, H2O2, which breaks down over time. It breaks down. But a lot of times, reactions take a long time to do. This will break down into two molecules of what? HIJKLMNO, what's that? Water, right? H2O. I asked that on a test one time. I gave it a freebie. What's the formula for water? And some kid put HIJKLMNO. So I gave him a point extra credit because I thought it was pretty creative. And he got 1 out of 100 on the test. So, okay, so we have hydrogen peroxide will yield water and it will yield oxygen, but it takes a long time to do that. But there's things that can improve it. We can shine a light on it, and temperature will make this reaction go a little faster. That's why your hydrogen peroxide is in brown bottles, by the way, because we don't have light on it, so that it maintains its hydrogen peroxidity. And what we have here is we have a curve here for a reaction. This is the way we draw a reaction rate curves, and a lot of times there's this hill. There's always this hill called the activation energy, and we got to get over that before the reaction proceeds. A lot of times it's a really big hill. And if we can do anything to make the hill smaller, then it's easier for the reaction to go. One thing we can do is we can add what's called a catalyst. A catalyst is just a chemical, an element, something I can put in there that'll make this reaction, that'll lower the hill. It'll lower the hill, but the catalyst is really unique because it doesn't get used in the reaction at all. I could use it forever. It doesn't get changed in the reaction at all. It's always the same. And I can just use it over and over and over again to change the hydrogen peroxide into water and oxygen. It just lowers the hill for us. That's a catalyzed reaction. You can see when I put the catalyst in, I got this nice little tiny hill that's a little bit more surmountable. It's easier to get over and do that. So I have a catalyst, and we're going to put it in here real quick. I'm going to move this. And I call this experiment the genie in a bottle. It's going as fast as it was last night. It's going to go. No, what is it? What is it? It's oxygen, and really, actually, most of it is water vapor, because this is an exothermic reaction, which means what? Gives off a lot of heat. Notice the size of the bottle now? Kind of hot. It's so hot that it melts the bottle down to like a liter. Wow, like a liter bottle. Okay? It's melted plastic on it. Okay? All right. So, John 16:33. Have you ever in your life come to hills, mountains that are before you that just look like they're insurmountable? You can't do it? I imagine the Sparks family is having one of those right now. An insurmountable mountain. What do I do? How can I get over this mountain? With faith, what can you do? You can move mountains. By who? Who helps you do that? God, Christ, helps you do that. He is our catalyst. He is unchanging. Nothing we do affects Him, but He can remove those mountains for you. I have told you these things so that in me you may have peace. In this world you will have trouble. You will. You will have trouble. But take heart. I have overcome the world, and I'll help you. You have your break. I'm sorry I went over.